All right, we are back after a short lunch break, once again here at the Culpeper County Library. Ben Gross here with Gene Kane, talking about life at USGS. So when we last left off, we had finished talking a great deal about instrumental projects that you had been working on, the multi-element atomic absorption spectrometer, as well as the plasma-based atomic emission spectrometer. But in 1988, it looks like you became involved with something new, the USGS Geochemical Reference Sample Program. Can you talk a little bit about how you got involved?
Indeed. I took over, actually, a program that I'd been long familiar with at USGS when Frank Flanagan, who was the head of the program, retired. He had fundamentally started the program at USGS, a precursor even before his involvement was the work that was done collaboratively with USGS, Carnegie Institute in Washington, MIT Geosciences Department, back in the early 50s when a granite and a diabase were developed as reference samples that could be used primarily for the calibration of DC arc optical emission spectrometry. The difficulty with that technique was that the arc in exciting the sample does behave somewhat differently with each different matrix that you're looking at, and so there was no pure standard that could be used in quite the way that with gravimetric analysis you were simply working with mass, and that was very easily characterized and
right.
Things of that sort. So you needed a calibration standard to be able to apply the DC arc optical emission technique to routine analyses, and the standardization was considered to be quite difficult. So at the beginning, something on the order of 30 or 40 rock laboratories around the country known or thought to be expert in geochemical analysis were asked to analyze what was the same material. The granite was collected in Westerly, Rhode Island, the diabase W1, I think, was the Centerville Quarry in Centerville, Virginia.
Okay.
And these materials were then ground into the powder that would be used for rock analysis and were distributed to all of these laboratories so that everyone would be analyzing the same sample.
With the same, I guess I should ask this because you brought it up before. When you're talking about the term matrix in a geological sense, what does that normally refer to?
What that normally refers to is the major element composition.
Okay.
A rhyolite, for instance, has 70% silica, roughly. A granite has 50 or 60% silica. A basalt has on the order of 35 to 40%, and I may have the numbers
sure.
wrong, but fundamentally, it's that kind of a change. But every rock is a mixture of a number of different elements, and there are fundamentally 10 major oxides that make up a rock or that can be used to describe a rock composition, even though the rock itself is not specifically silicon dioxide, magnesium oxide, calcium oxide. In looking at an analytical report, everything is reported as oxides.
Okay.
And the summation then of the complete analysis should be 100%.
Right.
And so that is used as one quality marker. When you total all the oxides, do you get 100%? And that works fine until you have a lot of carbonate, for instance, because you're not doing a carbon analysis as part of the majors.
Okay.
So if you have calcium carbonate instead of calcium oxide,
that can throw things off.
And so you also do a loss on ignition, which should drive off any of the carbonate as CO2. And if you have that loss on ignition number to add back in, then everything should work out fine. Again, sulfur is a complicating factor. Some minerals have a great deal of one of the halogens in them. And so if you've got halogens, if you've got sulfur in anything but very, very trivial quantities, then you still run into problems. But fundamentally, most rock types, if you do your 10 majors, silica, aluminum, iron, calcium, sodium, potassium, I've left out one of them, magnesium, and then phosphorus, titanium, and manganese. Those are the majors and minors that if you analyze for all of those and you sum them, you should typically, once you've added in loss on ignition, get 100%.
For them and their oxides.
For them at, reported as oxides.
Okay.
And then you have the fact that iron could be FeO, or it could be Fe2O3.
Right.
And so then you get into other minor complications if you're reporting everything as Fe2O3 rather than doing speciation. But in general, the classical techniques would have determined just those elements.
Right.
And the thought was that gravimetry is a definitive method, properly carried out, everyone in the world who used it would get the same number within that very small measurement uncertainty where nothing is quite perfect.
Right.
And when they did these samples back in roughly 1952...
This is the basalt and the diabase.
This is the basalt and the diabase. They are actually granite and I think W2, I'm pretty sure, is a diabase. It's at the basalt end, but it's not actually all the way down to a basalt in terms of the iron, magnesium being dominant rather than the silica
in the matrix.
Of the rock. But again, every rock contains trace elements as well, and most of the time they're totally negligible. It doesn't impact the totaling. But the thought was that all of these numbers would come out about the same as across the 30, 40 laboratories. And for silica, they did. But for everything else, the disparities were described in the early literature as the bombshell or the shock to the entire analytical community. Not to the chemists, because the chemists understood that they had the potential for errors in their analysis, but for the geologists who were using the data to define this rock based on its chemical analysis has to be this specific rock type, it was mind-blowing.
And this was 1952,
and this was 1952. And USGS picked things up after that. Their first series of rocks, the Columbia River basalt, G2, which was from the same quarry that G1 had been from, GSP, which was a granite diorite, and a few others that W2 came out then. There was a series of six that were developed under Frank Flanagan's direction and then analyzed fundamentally through round robins. In doing G1 and W1, the aim was to find truly expert laboratories to do the analysis. As time went on, it was who out there in the world who does rock analyses is willing to contribute data to let us then try to arrive at a reference value for these materials. And so there was not quite the degree of control on the quality of the individual laboratory contributions. Reference values were developed, but there was no standardized process for data treatment that gave you anything like the statistical control of the quality of the reference value or the input data to it that exists in today's world. And so the values, different people were, once the database was published, Geological Survey of Canada, the South African Reference Materials Program, some laboratories in Scandinavia, the French, were all taking these databases that Flanagan had published and collected, and doing their own statistical manipulation on them. And so you might end up with six reference values for theoretically the same constituent in the same sample. And then, as analysts were using the reference material, either as a calibrant for a new instrumental technique that couldn't readily be calibrated any other way,
right,
or as a method validation material, am I getting the reference value? Well, yes, they were getting the reference value, but they had five or six of them to choose from, and they always chose the one they agreed with.
How convenient.
And so you didn't have a standard in the sense that we have been moving toward much more recently.
You now, a single unified,
everyone agrees that we will use this value and nothing else. As the reference value should be an indication of the true composition.
Okay.
And admittedly, because every measurement has some uncertainty in it, the true value will never be known to absolute perfection. But there are good estimates of it, and there are bad estimates of it. And as a function of how the materials are used, you may not be using the best estimate. The International Standards Organization came into being long after this program got started. And there were parallel programs in several other countries at different, the French CRPG, Center for Research, Petrographic and Geologic, and don't ask me to spell the French, but that's what it is.
Okay.
South African Reference Materials Program, and the Canadian Geological Survey, and others were all getting involved in this. And then the National Research Lab at the Los Alamos got into the act, not so much with preparing materials like this, but with going through the literature, and every time somebody reported the result they got on this material as part of a method validation publication, the group at Los Alamos would pull the number out and develop their own database that was larger than the original one that USGS, Flanagan, Fairbairn, Carnegie Tech or whether he was at MIT on that first batch of materials, I don't even remember.
Were these digital databases, like computer databases, or were they just books of values?
They weren't truly computer databases, because we're talking about the 40s and the 50s and the 60s.
Well, I can imagine there being spreadsheets of data or tables of data.
There were tables of data that would end up published in the literature, but initially I'm not sure when the first computerization of it became possible.
Okay.
Certainly the 50s, I doubt that it was computerized. I think it was, you know,
so they were typically
a lab notebook kind of. Everybody sent their thing in, and then the people who were collecting the data would have created a handwritten.
Okay.
That could have been turned into a typescript for the final publication.
Well, this was my question, but is are they being published as books or they were, circulated volumes?
They were initially
or?
Published as books.
Okay.
And I think even the Fairbairn study, even though the major collaborators were Carnegie and MIT, I think the Fairbairn was a USGS bulletin.
Now, was this all being done, once it got under USGS's kind of purview, was this work being done where you were at BAL?
When I was at BAL, we were using these rocks as our control materials and to validate methods.
Right.
We were extending the databases as the methods changed and improved, and we could either go to lower detection limit or add an element that had never been measured before to
right.
the database. So this was continuously being extended and then used in laboratories all over the, literally all over the world, because anyone who wrote to Frank Flanagan and said, may I have a bottle of your standard A, B, or C to use in my laboratory, he'd mail it off.
Right. I guess my question was more, this is a very, as you know, very analytical project by nature, right? Being
yes.
able to break these things down. Was the main analysis associated with the development of these standards, the initial, like, not so much extending it to different techniques, but the initial development of samples, was this being done under BAL, or was it being done in another part of USGS?
It was being done literally worldwide. I mean, again, the first two, the G1 and W1, that were the collaborative USGS, Carnegie, MIT, and I'm sure there were other labs because there were more than 30 labs who eventually participated, but they organized the study.
Okay.
You send the sample out and you ask people around the world to analyze it and send the data back to you.
And then you
do the statistical manipulation of the data to arrive at a reference value.
So where was that central hub? Where was Flanagan working?
Flanagan was in Reston.
Okay, so it was...
He was in Reston. They were originally at the Navy Yard in D.C., and
okay.
they moved to Reston sometime before I started working for them.
Right. So this was my question.
But he was at the National Center, which was Reston or its predecessor.
Okay, so Reston was kind of the hub.
Yes.
From which all of these things radiated out and then came
back. And everything came back.
So Flanagan was in the same building as you when
yes.
you were there.
Yes. By the time I was there, he was a rather cantankerous old gentleman. When he retired, he truly had made up his mind that nobody else on this globe could do the job that he had done. And he was not willingly leaving anything in the way of records of what he'd done behind. So there was a bit of a flap about that. That, you know, enough said. I had a very hard time finding any records when I took over the program. At the time I took over, there were the original 8 materials, and then there had been another set of 8 that I gave you the names of, broke
yes.
out the coding on.
Yeah, I have
that
them
was
here.
The second set. It's the second set plus a few, because I did 3 or 4 myself while I was there that may or may not be on there, that may or may not be on that sheet. There was also 2 manganese nodules, the Atlantic and Pacific nodules A1 and P1, and then there were three more beyond the eight in the HVO set. There was the BIR, which was an Icelandic basalt, DNC. What was the third one? I don't think it was I think W2 had been done before that, but maybe it hadn't. In any case, there were by then 18 or so standards that we were just giving away to anyone who asked for a control material, a standard rock, or whatever. And the main reason we were not only giving them away, but we were letting others develop the reference values for them. I mean, Gladney would collect data from the literature, and he'd say, I think the reference value ought to be X. Sid Abbey in Canada was doing the same kind of thing. Frank Flanagan did the original six, the BCR, the GSP, the G2, that set of materials, and did present what he thought were best values for them rather than just a tabulation of here's all the data. But he did not do the same thing for the others. And again, that left people with the option of going through the data themselves and deciding what they thought the reference value was. So it defeated the whole concept of it being a standard with an agreed upon value for individual constituents. And I think was the source of a great deal of very, very damaging confusion in geochemistry. As I said, other institutions were also doing the same kind of thing, and there was enough consensus, even though less than I think we could have had and should have had, that it truly did facilitate all of the development of the new techniques through the 60s, 70s, 80s, even, you know, on into the ICP mass spec, which was more the 90s, because people at least had some reference, even if it wasn't an ideal reference. They had some way of saying, well, I'm totally off the mark, or I'm doing reasonably well. And it then gave people who wanted to collaborate together and were looking at, okay, here's four labs who think we're all doing really first-class work, but our values differ by 10%, to get together and compare the details of their methods and see if they could figure out what was causing the discrepancies within the analytical procedure, and refine their methods so that now you've got a small group of labs who are coming closer to getting the same value. Because again, that true value really is an unknown quantity that you are trying to establish. But when you're using five different techniques, all of which have different theoretical bases, all of which have theoretical potential interferences or problems or sources of error, in many ways, the only way you know you've succeeded is when you all get the same result. This harmony of results from different labs using different techniques, as we were talking about proving that you've done a good job.
Right.
In many ways, in analytical chemistry, the only proof that you got the right answer is that it can be replicated in other laboratories. And so all of this development of standards is about giving people a quick and easy way of knowing that they're getting the right value, or that they're so far off that their method clearly doesn't work, and then giving them some basis for looking at where their errors might be.
Okay, so I have a few questions.
Okay.
One question is, given Flanagan's assertion that basically no one else could do the job as well as he did, or rather that he was not going to necessarily be helpful in training someone to succeed him, how did you get chosen to take over the post or the project?
I basically was chosen because in the course of doing all of my method development and using the materials and talking to people endlessly about, well, how do I know which of these literature values I want to agree with? I had shown an interest in the thought process of improving the values that nobody else had shown. I also had a math background, so that detailed statistical data analysis didn't scare the living daylights out of me. I was very happy to do that kind of thing. And again, I had looked at this whole business of error development and the way geologists would use the data and try to map, well, there is a trend across this province in concentration that suggests that out there, six, you know, miles from where we stopped sampling, there might well be an economically important ore body.
Right.
Or any, you know, I had shown that kind of interest in the way the data was used, that made it look like I would be somebody interested in and capable of handling the job.
Well, let's continue the thought process then. So they approach you because you have the necessary skill set plus an interest in the subject. Flanagan, however, isn't going to train you necessarily. So how did you go about kind of getting acculturated to the full extent of the program? Like, how did you come into the...
Basically, because through all the time I was there...
You already knew all of this?
I was looking at the literature for this kind of discussion. Geostandards newsletter had been in existence for a while, and I was reading all of the different people who were coming up with alternative methods, and I was looking at the discrepancies that they were arriving at in their take on what the reference value is. And the one example that I remember the best, because I cited it in numerous papers, niobium is a trace element that is very, very important in some mineralization of rock studies. And niobium in BCR was reported by different people for the best value to be between 14 and 20. Well, that's a pretty big spread.
14 and 20?
14 parts per million up to 20 parts per million. Well, 20 is not, it's 1.5 times 14 fundamentally.
Right.
So that's a big uncertainty. And if other analysts are using BCR to calibrate their X-ray fluorescence determination of niobium in rocks, and some of them are calibrating at 20 and some are calibrating at 14, then that error is introduced into all the worldwide geoanalytical surveys of what are the concentrations. I mean, every country maps the rocks in their country in terms of what is our baseline in this geographic area, our baseline in that geographic area. Niobium-tantalum ratio is one of the most important of the petrogenic ratios that people looked at, and I don't even remember in what context, but if you don't have a good niobium number and if you don't have a good tantalum number, or they can differ by 50% depending on who did the determination, then those ratios can vary all over the place. And so you're no longer able to get the petrogenic modeling that the geologist is trying to get out of the data. So, you know, and I was interested in all of that. And I was reading about all of those uses even while I was doing the bench determinations of some of these elements.
So once you get appointed, I assume that your responsibilities would involve kind of negotiating this correspondence network as people were sending in values? Is that...
Well, and there were also a couple of samples that had been prepared, and the one I worked on the most was, or to the greatest degree of completion before I left for NIST, was the Devonian Ohio Shale SDO. And I've got... that had actually been a sample that the IGC, International Geochemical Consortium, or International Geochemical Conference, or whatever, had worked on in the past, and no values had been finalized for it. But there was going to be an IGC meeting in Denver, in D.C., about the time I took over the program, and there was going to be an opportunity to get people working on this again. And oil shale was a big thing in the late 80s, early 90s, in terms of how can it be used and what can be done with it. So the thought of the conference was to go back to this material, and worked with a couple of the people in the Denver lab that had been instrumental in the earlier studies. And so we then sent that out to another group of people and collected a new batch of data.
These were
different labs all over the country, probably all over the world. I could find out fairly quickly. But in any case, sent it out, collected the data, and then based on my literature studies of what was being done other places and what the IAEA was recommending and what any number of other people, developed my own protocol for the statistical reduction of the data. And took it from there. We basically derived reference values directly, which Flanagan had not done on his two previous sets of materials. But then...
This is through statistical analysis.
And we were still doing a fair amount of data rejection, getting a preliminary average and standard deviation for all of the data, and then iteratively deleting anything that was more than two standard deviations away and narrowing the database down. Fundamentally, what you know from the start, this widespread divergence of data, has to be because some of the data is good and some of the data is an outlier. And when you get to NIST and when you get to the International Standards Organization, the rule of thumb is we do not reject data primarily on statistical grounds. We have to have analytically justifiable reasons for saying the data is biased.
What's an example of an analytically justifiable reason?
Let's say I'm doing beryllium in a salt by ICP.
Okay.
And the beryllium concentration is in a basalt going to be 1 or 2 ppm. And there will be a vanadium spectral overlap that will be 0.5 to 0.75 ppm. And so it's pretty doggone big compared to the true value. Your bias is 75% of the true value. And in the early days of ICP, when all of the interferences hadn't been totally worked out, the original publication of beryllium in a basalt included the vanadium overlap as well as the beryllium value. So it was an error by 50 to 75%.
Which was later ascertained and
which
corrected.
Which was later ascertained and corrected. So that's one example. Another example would be that in a lot of geochemistry, people are much more interested in the mobile concentration than in the immobile, what's totally locked up and will never dissolve out no matter how much rain falls, rivers flow over the rock. And so they will do a leachable. Well, if the leachable content is only 50% of the total, and that gets in the database from which you're trying to derive the true total concentration, it's a monumental error. So it's identifying things like that and knowing why they occur, and then either getting the correction or using an alternative method that isn't impacted at all by that error. And all of the ISO guidelines and all of the work at NIST and all of the work I've done with the IAG after I left USGS was about getting a database that was clean in the first place, that did not need data rejection by statistical techniques.
I see.
But that was not the reality in the early days of the geological reference materials, either at USGS or at any of the other places. With the possible exception, CanMet is not, I'm not sure whether the Canadian, where is CanMet? There is a group in Canada that was focused on the mining industry and on supporting the analytical data for the mining industry. And when you are trying to determine very, very accurately how whether the ore is economically worth even mining,
right,
or whether after or getting a sufficiently accurate assay that the mine and the refiner are going to agree on a sales price, you need very, very accurate analyses. And so CanMet standards were fundamentally ores and ore concentrates and not the fundamental baseline geochemical samples that the Geological Survey of Canada or that USGS would be looking at for the most part. So they were, and they had, that was the one place in which there were very carefully defined standard methods and literally certification of analysts in terms of testing their competence ahead of time and qualifying them to even be in the lab. That kind of thing is totally absent from most of the baseline geochemical work.
So one question I have that's sort of related to this point is about the extent to which individual judgment comes into play when deciding on what results are incorporated into these analyses. It's probably less of an issue on the labs that are doing the actual hands-on analysis, right? Because they have their set of data. And that's it.
That's it.
But when they send it all to you, especially as you're now the head of the program, you have to use a little bit of your own judgment,
you
right,
to
determine.
You have to use judgment. You have to know something about the broad mineralogy of the sample. You have to know something about where spectral overlaps are likely to be a major problem. And again, so much of that is matrix specific. This Devonian oil shale was a matrix I'd never worked on before.
Right.
It was a matrix that most of the people doing the analyses hadn't worked on before. But when I looked at the neutron activation data and saw that it was dramatically different for one element, and I don't even, I can find the element. but there was a nuclear overlap that would normally not be encountered because, again, in most rocks, I mentioned the vanadium on beryllium overlap. In most rocks, vanadium is down around 50 parts per million or less, but in the basalt, it's 350 or more. Then beryllium in any granitic rock, which is what we analyzed more often than not for beryllium, is up around 10 to 15 parts, but in a basalt, it's down at one part. So you've got a total flip between the concentration of the element you're trying to determine and the concentration of what might cause a spectral interference.
Huh.
And the magnitude of the interference was such that it mattered dramatically on a basalt, but as you moved to the more siliceous rocks, became utterly insignificant and not worth thinking about. And this varies matrix to matrix. It varies rock type to rock type, which is your matrix factor. And again, there was a nuclear overlap that was dramatic.
So you needed to be aware not only of the distinction between different types of rocks or matrix compositions, but also the analytical errors that could arise.
And some of it was simply a matter of neither the nuclear activation group, the neutron activation group that had done the analysis, nor I was aware of this interference that I'm talking about here, until we looked at the data and said, you differ by 20% from four other methods that theoretically measured exactly the same element.
Right.
Let's go look for the cause.
Were you the ultimate arbiter on these questions as the head of the program? Were you basically the one who's...
Basically, I'm going to each of the analysts and saying, okay, here's a problem I see in your data.
Right.
Help me figure out why.
Okay.
More than, you know, because I really wanted to be able, if you're going to improve the reference sample database, what you've got to be able to do once you see that these discrepancies appear is to figure out why. But I couldn't do that for all methods in all matrices.
Sure.
I had to turn that back to the analyst who had contributed the data.
Now, to what extent did this role that you played parallel or differ from that that Flanagan had kind of established when he set things up?
Well, I think when Flanagan first did it, he was paying a fair amount of attention to that kind of thing. But I think over the years...
He kind of got
more distant and didn't do the follow-through, getting the rock collected, getting it ground, getting it into the bottle, getting the preliminary sense that, yes, the material in bottle 1 and in bottle 100 and in bottle 700 in the run all produced the same result by this technique. That was, in many regards, his signature contribution, the bottle-to-bottle variability. Have we documented that, in fact, it's absent? And, again, he was doing that in the days when DC-ARC was the primary way of looking at trace elements. And so DC-ARC is a semi-quantitative method, and the ability to see these differences gets better and better and better as the precision of the method improves. He wasn't able to see differences
right.
that I could see by the time I was working on the program.
As a result of your previous experience working with these different types
right.
of instrumentation.
Right.
Okay.
And, you know, each of the new instruments, the precision got better. And so then you were able to see differences between methods that hadn't been apparent before, Because again, if I want to use a standard analysis of variance, are these two numbers different? The difference has to be pretty big compared to the within method standard deviation for 15 or 20 repeats.
Right.
It can't just be 3% or 5% different if the uncertainty within is 5%. It's got to be more like 15 or 20%. So the differences that could be judged statistically significant got smaller and smaller and smaller as methods and instrumentation improved and analytical capability got better. So that one of the things I worked on at USGS, not only did the geologic division do these reference materials, but the branch of exploration geochemistry had done a set called the GXR samples, geological exploration reference materials. And those had been done primarily to look at the trace elements that were highly enriched in these particular samples compared to baseline geochemistry. But they were also done largely with the six-step semi-quant, where you had a 20% standard deviation. You know, you're saying the six steps where it's between 1 and 20, it's between 20 and 40.
Right.
You know, and so it's reported as the midpoint, and those aren't the right steps because there were six of them. But nevertheless, it was a semi-quantitative rather than a truly quantitative method. And they had looked primarily at the 14 highly mineralized trace elements that were important in exploration, not at the major oxides.
Hmm.
And as time went on, and the routine geoanalyst was having to do more and more and more with mineralized samples, these had come to be used as the control material for pretty much anything, including the major oxides, which they were never intended to be used for.
Right.
And there's a long, convoluted story, but in the grinding process, using an alumina ball mill, the alumina balls kept getting smaller and smaller. The alumina kept getting added to
into
the
samples. Right.
And so the aluminum concentration from the beginning of the preparation process to the end of the preparation process varied by several percent. I mean, by vastly more than analytical error could ever either account for or, you know, so if people were taking a reference value that had been developed by Los Alamos based on their four bottles, it might be totally non-representative of what another lab had. You know, if they've got a 2% bottle and you've got a 3% bottle, but you ought to be able to determine aluminum to a tenth of a percent or better, and you're calibrating with the wrong one or you're using the wrong value for your control check, you're saying, you know, I'm so far off, I can't understand what's going on. And so one of the studies I did later on and that made me very aware of the homogeneity issue was to go back and document the fact that these materials had been prepared for a very specific trace element purpose, were being used
to look for oxides.
For major oxides. And because of this, totally unnoticed, inadvertent preparation problem. They were being used for something that nobody should ever have thought to use them for.
Now, were you involved in setting up procedures so that one could avoid similar preparation issues? For example, coming up with a bore that didn't contaminate the sample?
Well, I looked at the whole problem differently. Certainly the preparation techniques, just like the analytical techniques, changed over time and the materials that you could use in the grinding process. But it was always something you had to be aware of.
Right.
The French group ran into the same thing using tungsten carbide grinding equipment and contaminating one of their tungsten samples, one of the samples that was supposed to be a control for tungsten, and was at a totally non-representative level in the rock, because you're trying to do 97 different things at the same time with these standards. First, you're trying to give people a material that they can use as a calibrant for an instrumental technique that is much more readily calibrated with a matrix sample than with pure solution standards. ICP and AA, using a single element pure solution standard is trivial. But in other cases, like your solid neutron activation, it's hard, much harder to do. Your X-ray diffraction, or not diffraction, but X-ray fluorescence, it's much harder to do. So there were many techniques that are preferentially calibrated against a natural matrix material, but you want it to be representative of the matrix that people are going to be analyzing. And you want people to group their samples so that the major matrix errors that might occur in that kind of a process are eliminated.
Right.
At the same time you're trying to do that, you really do want samples that are representative of the real world. So you contaminate them in the grinding process, they're no longer representative of the real world matrix that you're trying to match. You're also trying to give people a way to validate a new method. And it gets complicated to find a single material which will serve all of these purposes.
Well, this is what I'm curious about, is ultimately the decision of when the sample is fixed comes down, I assume, to an individual's judgment.
Which
is your judgment in this case, right?
And fundamentally, on the SDO, on the disseminated gold, I had the coal standard, the Lowers Bakersfield cold, CLB, almost finished when I left. Not quite. Those three are the ones that I had the largest degree of responsibility for. And actually getting those done with the degree of focus on, let's standardize the data reduction process. Let's make it as close to what NIST does, what ISO recommends, as we can. And then let's say we're going to stay with it, or at least for a reasonable period of time, because when we developed the IAG protocol after I left NIST, we deviated even further. Refined even further and improved the process. But it's to get past the point that everyone is looking at a literature database of 30 values and saying, I agree with this one, therefore this one is right and I'm right, rather than having a more cohesive way of actually evaluating your data and demonstrating. Because by the ISO definition, the reference value in non-certified materials or the certified value in a NIST material is by definition the true value for the concentration. And so if everybody's got a different idea of what the true value is, and they're using their own definition in setting up their calibration curve,
right,
everything else they do,
right, there's no way to
reconcile things.
Hence the need for a central ultimate decision.
A central ultimate decision, but it took a long time to get there.
So,
I mean, there was a central decision on G1 and W1.
Right.
For the major oxides.
Sure.
Only for the major oxides.
Right.
Everything that came after that, until SDO, the numbers were in a whole lot more flux. There was a whole lot more opportunity because Flanagan put the compilation together and may have developed an average, but then Abby in Canada would develop an average that was based on rejecting everything three standard deviations away from his preliminary average, and somebody else would develop another average that was involved rejection of everything that was two.
Right.
And so there was no one decision.
Until
I basically said, hey, USGS, if you guys are going to do these materials, we've got to follow the sense that even though legally we cannot call ourselves a certifying body, we've got to tell people we believe this to be the true value. Use this value, period, flat, final. Until we find an error in it and revise it and publish the revision. Because again, ISO defines a certifying body as a technically competent deliverer of reference values. And a certifying body like NIST is unquestionably, I mean, they've got some of the most sophisticated analytical capability and the highest emphasis on finding every potential error and developing truly accurate numbers. They do very, very well sometimes. They occasionally blow it right out of the water, but that's beside the point. They are also a tad, if it wasn't made at NIST, it can't be any good.
Right.
And the USGS materials, because NIST never made any rocks that were certified for the elements of interest to geochemistry, had no alternative, really, but to do these kinds of collaborative things. And it just took years of... It's that slow evolution we were talking about at lunch of the process to make it the best that it possibly could be. And yet, step by step along the way, because techniques got better, the numbers in the database, even if the reference value wasn't as carefully defined as I might like, the numbers got better.
Mm.
And all of geoanalysis and all of what the geologists could do in the way of geochemical modeling of what are the earth processes improved with each step along the way and could never have happened without the development of the rock standards, whatever their limitations were.
So you were in charge of the program for 2 years.
Two years.
Maybe basically. A little bit more?
Two and a half. I mean, it wasn't terribly long.
Which means that you said that you went from the beginning of SDO to nearly the end of it during that time. Was that typical,
well,
like a two-year...
I finished the SDO. The publication didn't come out until after I was there again because of all
right, there's
got to
be... Okay,
but I finished SDO before I went to NIST. I came very close to finishing both the coal and the disseminated gold. The disseminated gold was actually a totally new material that two people from the exploration geochemistry branch went out to collect at the Pinson Mine in Nevada. We were near Las Vegas. And I actually went out and spent a week in the field with them doing preliminary field testing of different areas around the mine to see where we could get the best sample for the concentrations we wanted, and doing preliminary analysis of the rocks in a very, very, well, I mean, it was sophisticated for the time, in the way of a field lab that where you could go out and do a lot of the exploration geochemistry was done in the field rather than back in the lab.
Was this your first time doing extended field work?
It was the only time I did field work. Everything else was, you know, in the lab. And
how did it compare?
We were grinding samples, and we were ashing samples, and we were, you know, digging, you know, chipping with hammers at pulling rocks out of the ground. It was interesting. I do not think I would have wanted to do it permanently and full time, but as part of, again, of the learning process of how you determine that the rock is worth collecting in the first place, to convert it to a standard, it was very, very interesting. And I had a repeat experience. I was at NIST still when one of the geoanalysis conferences had a two-day workshop on the preparation of reference materials, where we went into the field and collected the material. And Phil Potts and I were doing the classroom part of the teaching of all the theory of reference materials and the discussion of preparation techniques, but then we actually went into the field and chipped rocks and collected what became one of the Open University samples.
Right. So 2 years or so of working at USGS on this program.
Right.
During which time you basically took a couple of rocks from, in some cases, literally the field to
a finished standard,
and that 2 year time frame that was pretty close to typical for, you know, beginning to end. Was that about right?
Well, not. It should be.
Okay.
It should be. It very often is not, either because you want to determine elements that haven't been developed before, and you can't find enough quality data in that time frame.
Right.
By the time I got to, well, NIST does the vast majority of their standards in-house. That was not always the case. And it is not exclusively the case in that many of their metals, for example, are, again, commercially important steels and whatever that are done collaboratively the way the USGS materials were, a collaborative analysis rather than an in-house, only our own people. That they would do through the metal industry in conjunction with the metals subcommittee of ASTM. NIST did a lot of that kind of collaboration. We did with the metals industry, with the glass industry, with a number of others where only a small part of the analytical work would be done in-house. But in terms of most of the chemical composition SRMs at NIST, everything or the vast majority was done in-house. They would occasionally hand select an outside laboratory to add to their capabilities, but for the most part, they truly didn't trust outside labs to get data as good as theirs.
I was talking about it mostly in the context of the USGS, but since you segued into NIST, I only have one more question before we get
fully into
NIST. And the question is your involvement with the newsletter or periodical Geostandards and Geochemical Analysis, which you mentioned you got involved with during this
I got involved with that, again, when Frank Flanagan retired, because he and Kupisami Govindaraju over in France, who had, you know, his counterpart at CRPG, had been the original editors of the journal, and Govindaraju certainly wanted USGS to be part of it and on the editorial board and what have you. So as soon as I took over from Frank, I was invited to join the editorial board. And it was, you know, again, the first publication of our finished SDO material was in the journal. This was a much more detailed USGS bulletin that provided far more detail, obviously, on the error than you could possibly provide in the journal. I mean, this is 100 pages, and the journal was much less.
Yeah, that report you have here, that is far too long for a journal.
Too large for a journal.
So this was your first time, actually, I assume, as an editor of a journal.
Yes.
What was that like?
The editorial board, in many ways, Govindaraju did all of the final editing, but we were the primary source of reviews for papers that were submitted.
Okay.
And at the time that he was doing it, before Phil Potts took over as editor, it was fundamentally where the databases of any reference material project would be published. It did not do a great deal with methods. It's also where all the literature in the early years on 6 different ways of evaluating the data would be published.
Right.
So the journal has changed greatly over the years in terms of what it does. But the very first G1W1 was published in Spectrochemacta, or some journal of that sort. And very quickly, those journals started rejecting standards databases as not being real research. And so Geostandards Newsletter was started as a way of, we've got to get this data out there, or the standards have no value to people.
So this was the main
method of disseminating whatever was being done with regard to, you know, the methods papers, to the degree that they were published, were, I have applied ion selective electrode methodology to fluorine, chlorine, bromine in 97 reference materials. And then it would be the data.
Right.
It'd be a very brief description of the method.
Followed by a data table.
Hmm. So it was the primary means of getting that data out there.
Okay. So once you joined the editorial staff, did the format change in any way, or did you just kind of keep doing?
Well, the format didn't change until Govindaraju retired, which was 4 or 5 or 6 years after Frank Flanagan did. But then Phil Potts became the editor, and it started taking a very different shape. We, at that point, devised editorial guidelines that said every reference material article had to talk about the degree to which the work was in compliance with the International Standards Organization guidelines for reference material development, which had never been the case before.
Right.
And again, we weren't trying to force people to adopt the guidelines entirely, but we were trying to nudge people gradually in that direction and to at least begin to talk about, well, the guidelines say I should do X, but X is totally impossible in the practical world. And the closest I could come is Y. And, you know,
Just get them thinking about those issues.
Because at some point, and I don't know exactly where, between leaving USGS and now, but at some point I described the ISO guidelines for reference material production, describe being able to achieve everything they ask you to achieve as being the equivalent of getting a perfect 800 on an SAT test. It ain't gonna happen very often. Most of the world will never be able to do this.
But as long as they're thinking of that and aware of that.
But as long as they're thinking of that and aware of that, they will do a better job than they would have done before.
Okay.
And it can be that sense of continuous quality improvement that Deming and a few others preached long and hard, and that, you know, the sense that every day can be a little better than the day before. I may never achieve perfection. I not only may never, I will never. But as long as I am striving,
right, moving up,
there will be something that gets better and is done a little more carefully and thoughtfully.
Okay. So that was probably one of your major contributions to, along with the rest of the editorial board, to the way that geostandards
developed in the way the IAG, when it formed, I think the first meeting was actually 97.
This is the
International Association of Geoanalysts.
Okay.
Which formed out of, now, Geoanalysis 90, I was still at USGS. I was invited as a speaker, and USGS is within the Department of the Interior. And every now and again, the Department of the Interior would say, Interior does not include Canada.
Technically true.
We will not fund your trip, period, flat, final. If you go, it's at your own expense, or you get the meeting organizers to pay your way.
Wait, this was the...
This was the first geoanalysis meeting, which was organized jointly by Geological Survey of Canada and Geological Survey of the Province of Ontario.
Okay.
And I had met these folks at FACS meetings. They had seen some of my early papers talking about reference values aren't quite what they could be in Geostandards newsletter. They knew I had taken over from Flanagan. They wanted me at the meeting. And I finally said to them flat out, I can't get there unless you pay for the trip, unless you take care of everything.
Right.
USGS will not do this. And they said, of course we will. And so in the sense of in the geological community, I felt like all of my really serious mentoring and higher levels of support came initially from Canada, and then through that 1990 meeting in Canada, from the people in Great Britain who formed the International Association of Geoanalysts.
Okay.
Those are the people I look to as the support structure more than anyone.
More than in the United States? More than USGS?
USGS, yes, in terms of the chemistry part.
Right.
There was a lot of collegiality and sharing and learning from virtually everyone in the branch. But in terms of this next step in my career, the support...
You mean in terms of
the encouragement, the people to talk to about what I was doing, to get ideas from...
You're talking about the standard materials.
I'm talking about the standard materials. That was all the Brits and the Canadian.
Okay. So this seems like a good segue point to talk about how you went from being at USGS, where the emphasis from what you just said was more on the chemistry side of things, to NIST, which is explicitly a standards organization.
Program.
So how did you get involved with NIST in the first place?
NIST, the reference materials program, called me and said, would you be interested? And I went for an interview.
And they were in
Gaithersburg, Maryland, which was three times as far, but only 5 minutes further in terms of driving time, just because of 70-mile-an-hour highways instead of backcountry roads. They offered me the position in the reference materials program, It was very interesting. I don't remember exactly the titles. There was Bill Reed was SRMP chief.
That's standard reference
materials program. And Tom Gills was under him, and he was the one who had more direct with the project managers as opposed to the program. And he was the one who invited me to come. And it was in many ways a very, very wise move, because USGS by 95 had a massive layoff that I probably would not have survived. And between the time I left and 95, the title of the Washington Post magazine section article shortly after was The Day the Axe Fell at USGS. I mean, it was big.
Was there a particular reason for the cuts, or?
Government funding, government's too big, and there were too many places where they simply had not delivered the expected product, and the budget just got chopped hugely.
But by then, you were safely out of there.
By then, I was safely out of there, but in the meantime, a large part of the Reston group that I had been a part of was transferred to Denver. And I could never have made the transfer. I mean, my husband would not have stood for it.
He was still working at DOE at
this time. No, he was at DOE only 5 years, and then he opened his own consulting shop to represent before DOE and before Congress any of the refiners who were too small to have a full-time Washington office.
Right.
So he was in business for himself, but he was getting ready to retire.
And you were still living at this point in
Vienna?
We
were still in Vienna. And the thought of a move to Denver would absolutely have been unthinkable. I think they would have left me in Reston with the standards program there in spite of everything, if I'd still been around, but I don't know that for sure. And I know that a move to Denver would never have worked. And I was eligible to retire in 95, but I would not have been eligible to retire sooner.
Sure.
So, everything worked out beautifully. And I loved the job at NIST. While Bill Reed was office chief, But once he got moved aside and Tom Gills took over, in spite of the fact that Tom was the one who brought me in and who seemed like he would have done anything and everything to make it really work, very quickly turned. Tom, I was accustomed to working quite independently. I was accustomed to saying, I've got a problem. Do you have any ideas on how to solve it? But not on going day to day. How should I do my job?
Right.
Tom wanted that kind of control. And while Bill was still over Tom, I had someone running interference.
But as soon as
he left. As soon as he left, the interference was gone. And in spite of the fact that I loved the work, I hated the job. If that's, you know, if that dichotomy is possible.
Right.
So this was all during the time when the whole concept of telecommuting was getting started.
Right. This is 1990. You
this was 91 that I went to NIST. And
91?
90, I believe it was 91.
Okay.
That I went to NIST. Yeah, I think it was, okay, yeah. Sometime in late 87 or early 88, I took over from Frank. And it was March of 91 that I went to NIST. And I stayed until October 1 of 95. The work was described to me by some people as, oh, Gene, you've moved from chemistry to sales. And I said, I didn't think that's what I'd done. If that's what I've done, somebody rather badly deceived me as to what this job was. And I did not handle the job as though I had moved to sales. I handled the job as though I were the manager of a reference material project that was totally dependent for the chemical data on the analytical division, that was totally dependent for the data reduction on the statistical engineering division, but that still had me helping to design what the measurements ought to look like, looking at individual pieces of the data as they were coming in and saying, yes, I think we've got a problem, or no, I think we're in really good shape. And even doing some of my own independent statistical engineering was going to do the final data reduction, but I could play with the numbers. And I could still do all the kinds of thinking about, I had responsibility for all of the geological materials, and I knew that the geological community had nothing that was really a quality reference material, despite the fact that USGS was working on it for the platinum group elements. I knew that we had nothing that was really first class for tantalum and niobium and for some of the other what's called high field strength elements that are, again, very important in petrogenic modeling. I knew we had nothing for the rare earth elements, which were not only important in geochemical modeling, but were a way of identifying which power plant was having its ash drop out in the environment, whether carried in the air for a while and then finally settling out. But the rare earth patterns for coal ash could tell people specifically which coal mine had produced the coal that was causing this fallout environmentally.
Huh.
And there were no rare earth certifications whatever by NIST. There were no high field strength. There were no platinum elements.
Neither by NIST or by USGS.
Well, and USGS was certainly, and all of the other geological groups that did reference materials, were working on it. But there was not that totally definitive reference value.
Which is what NIST was aiming for.
Which is what NIST was always aiming for and should have been able to produce. But again, because NIST was Department of Commerce, with very few exceptions, if the material did not have a commercial application or need, NIST was not going to do baseline geochemistry.
Wouldn't those sorts of pollution issues, for example, qualify?
Those sorts of pollution issues became very important as EPA became a partner with NIST on reference material development and the very first coal and coal ash standards that go back. I used them in my very first weeks at USGS when I was doing coal ash analyses, so they date back to the early 70s, were done collaboratively by NIST and by EPA, and they did include the pollutant elements that EPA was wanting to monitor, but they did not include a lot of elements that the geological community would have been interested in.
Things like the platinum group elements,
right,
or what have you.
So while I was at NIST, we did do two platinum palladium standards, and I was directly involved in those. Enco is a mine up there in Canada, up in Ontario somewhere. Nickel primarily, but all nickel ore has precious metals in it. And somehow Enco was involved perhaps in providing the platinum palladium that went into automobile catalysts. Perhaps they were actually a collector of used catalysts to try to retrieve the
right
platinum and palladium out of them. And probably a little of both, and again, that was a long time ago. But that was one of the first projects I worked on at NIST. I worked on several right off the bat.
I mean, when you got invited, what was the specific responsibility they said you were going to have?
Every single one, I was the project manager of about 90 reference materials.
Okay.
Some of which were already in stock, most of which were already in stock.
And a few you got
and
to
a
pursue.
Few that we were in process of making, or even just at the beginning of going out and finding the material. In terms of what was already in stock, the primary responsibility was to determine how long the material in stock would last and whether we ought to be making the next generation, because we were going to run out in less than the time frame, or in just barely over the time frame that it normally took NIST to finish a material, which was 2 to 4 years.
Right.
So I had that responsibility, and then I had the responsibility of, if a customer called and said, you know, I'm having trouble matching your result, what do you think might be wrong with what I'm doing, or are you sure your number's right? Then I would investigate that query from a customer.
So this is where the sales aspect.
This is where the sales aspect, but to me it wasn't even sales. If I'm telling them what's wrong with their analytical method as to why they can't match our value, or I'm researching whether we made a mistake in the methods we use to develop the method, that to me was more science than it was sales.
So the types of customers that you were dealing with, you're using the term customer, which I assume was what NIST referred to them as.
Right.
Who were typical customers government labs, scientific facilities?
The whole realm. Corning Glass would be a customer for some of the glass standards in terms of monitoring the control over their manufacturing processes.
Wait, there were glass standards too?
There were glass, I had all of the rock standards. I had all of the environmental sediments and soils that were being used for pollution monitoring. I had all of the spectrometric solutions that were being used for the calibration of ICPAA type analyses, the anion solution standards that were being used for the calibration of ion selective electrodes. I had the coals and the coal ashes. I had the physical properties of glasses. And then with Inco, we developed an automotive catalyst standard where you were analyzing the catalyst, the spent catalyst material for the platinum elements that were still in it.
Okay.
So, I mean, I have an enormous range of materials, and the customers might be in Europe, they might be in the United States, they might be in Canada, they were government labs, they were EPA labs, they were university labs, they were
mostly labs.
They were anything and everything.
But they could be in industry, academia, government.
They could be anywhere.
Military.
Anywhere, all over the globe.
So not just in Europe, but also in Asia or in other parts of the world?
Yeah.
Interesting. This was a very different sort of interaction. I know, as you said, normally you like to kind of ensconce yourself in your lab and kind of work on problems.
Right.
This must have been a very strange transition to be.
It was very different. Again, as long as I was working with a fairly small group of chemists on an individual project and kind of brainstorming the chemistry, what should we add to the certification that we're not thinking about, it was perfectly comfortable. It was not a whole lot different as I was at USGS going to a technical conference and presenting a paper and dealing with questions from the audience. The difficulty came in when I would challenge their science.
There being the customers?
They're being NIST.
Oh, they're being NIST.
Okay. As I said, most of the chemical analyses that in the projects I worked on were done in-house, but occasionally they would invite an outside laboratory. And there were some things where, quite frankly, in terms of the matrix that was involved, we did fluoride in vegetation because the fallout from an Alcoa plant on pasture land surrounding the plant was doing dental damage to the cattle that were grazing there. You know, the excess fluoride browns the teeth and causes all kinds of weird spotting and this, that, and the other thing. And so suddenly there was an environmental concern about we need fluoride in vegetation, but the fluoride was pretty much wrapped up in the aluminum rather than in the vegetable matter.
Oh, wow.
And the industrial people who also did these analyses in partnership with NIST got very different results from the neutron activation group. And I had the audacity to defend the outside labs.
That sort of behavior was not normally tolerated, I assume?
Not normally tolerated. NIST was God. And
according to NIST.
According to NIST. And in many, many ways they were. But they had more time and they had more money to spend on a project than literally anybody else in the world in terms of this kind of analysis or at least, you know, of any of the industrial labs or geological labs that might collaborate with them. And then they were going to sell the material, where USGS was giving their materials away, so they were retrieving part of what they spent on doing this work. And they just, I mean, they had every advantage. They should have been able to do better than anyone else.
So how did they respond when you raised these questions?
They did not like it. But in the end, I believe on that one, I mean, again, I spent days in the library looking for information on the methods these other people were using and what kinds of things could have gone wrong. And if you've got three outside methods that agree and one NIST one that doesn't, it's not proof that NIST is wrong, but it leads to a strong suspicion. And then when I found in the literature a neutron activation report that talked about problems with and interferences in this particular determination, I said, hey guys, you show me that this didn't happen in your analysis, or I'm going with the other numbers. And again, Bill Reed backed me up, and we went with the other numbers. And
now, did you have at this point, were you basically working on your own again? I know that you were a manager.
The SRM office, each of the project managers, and there were five of us, one with the ASTM metals project and, you know, one with the health and clinical type materials, and then I had mine, and I don't remember what the other was. We each had our own little cubicle, and for the most part, it was a desk job in the way of tracking what was happening, going to the library and doing the literature studies that would inform the next project, meeting one-on-one with the statistical engineering people as they were working on data reduction. But it was kind of a, yes, I could be by myself in my own little cubbyhole. And, you know, the phone would ring and I'd have to answer a question for a customer. And usually that was, again, it was a puzzle to solve. And I could take my time in the library and call them back 2 or 3 days later if need be. So that it was a new intellectual challenge. It was something I thoroughly enjoyed doing.
What types of questions did you find, do you recall, like the most challenging set of materials or the ones that kind of provoked the most questions?
Not really. I mean, having to deal with that kind of thing actually turned out to be a fairly small part of the job.
What was the major part of the job?
The major part of the job was keeping track of all of these materials that I was responsible for, writing articles for American Lab and Environmental Lab magazines, which really, you know, are not scientific journals as such, but advertised the newest material or that promoted, here it is, come get it, so that you're promoting sales, but you're still writing about the scientific merit of using the material. And then, as I say, just fundamentally, I mean, I worked on three reference materials during their process of certification at NIST. I probably worked on 30 or 40 at USGS in a space of time that wasn't much longer. So that keeping track of all of it and monitoring what was happening and are we on track or are we running behind it, drafting the certificate of analysis and drafting the publication information and even helping to update the catalog, the sales catalog and things of that sort.
So it was a very different sort of world than
USGS. It was
USGS.
A totally different world. I guess the one question that I can recall very specifically came up because I had been asked to review a paper for the analyst. And the author on the first round of review had been told, you don't have any reference material reports in your manuscript to validate the quality of your method in the data you're producing. You need to add that. And they added it.
Right.
They unfortunately added a reference value that had been gotten out of a catalog with a misprint in it.
Oh.
Instead of off the certificate of analysis.
Oh, no.
And they had matched the wrong number.
So you had to go
and
back.
And I flagged that for the journal, at which point they told me, oh, that's only in there because the last reviewer told them it had to be. And here I'm telling them it's totally unusable. But that's, you know, again, you should work from the certificate.
Right.
Not from any other source. And if a certificate is not produced, or if over the 5 to 10 years you're using a material and haven't exhausted the supply, you lose the certificate.
The materials come with the certificate.
The materials come with the certificate from US, from NIST.
Right.
And they do now from USGS and from IAG and from most other places. But at the time that I first took over from Flanagan, we were not producing certificates at all.
At USGS.
At USGS. And the main reason we were not was strictly political. Because NIST, at the time of its founding, was MBS rather than NIST, but at the time of its founding was chartered as the only standards producer for the U.S. government.
Hence, it was the only one that could issue certificates.
Right.
Okay.
Eventually, USGS management changed its mind and decided that because NIST did not certify rocks for any of the elements that were of importance to geologists, and because EPA was certifying their materials by then, perhaps we could ignore the fear that we would get taken, raked over the coals. But it, again, it was an evolutionary process to get that mind change. So USGS now does issue certificates. In fact, I may even, do I have the SDO certificate in here? I thought I put it in. But they do now issue certificates for their materials, and they're probably on the website. But when I was there and when Flanagan was working on it, that was a major, major impediment to doing the job the way it should have been done, just because we were told, no, you may not.
So that was, along with the choice of samples then, that was a major distinction between the SRM and the USGS samples. Initially.
Right. They were called the USGS standard rocks, in quotes.
But you weren't allowed to call them official standards.
But you weren't allowed to call them official standards.
Until later.
And now I think they are calling, I mean, ISO distinguishes between reference material and certified reference material. And the basic distinction is that a certified reference material must be accompanied by a certificate. A reference material doesn't have to be.
Hmm.
But if you read between the lines, And all of the ISO guides that IAG and NIST, well, NIST has been central in developing them, and IAG has been trying to implement them. All of them talk about a reference material is a material for which a property value is well enough known that the material can be used for calibration and method validation. Well, so is the CRM. The fundamental distinction is there a certificate attached?
Right.
And has an uncertainty been attached to that
certified value?
Certified or reference value. And USGS initially did not do uncertainties at all. And the way I am now handling them with the IAG is totally different than what I did with SDO. Again, it's been an evolution. The whole concept of traceability has been much more evident over the last 10 or 15 years than it had been before. But my fundamental argument on all of this is that for accreditation purposes, every laboratory, podunk you, whatever, has to have quality control materials, has to show that they are getting correct values on them. Well, on half the things that people might want to measure, a NIST certified reference material doesn't exist. They're very, very big on the things that are regulated, food, drug, nutrient standards, EPA pollutants, toxicity, that kind of thing. But for so much of basic routine every day, the ordinary sample, as opposed to the one of either environmental contamination interest or very, very critical industrial need, because producing that standard is so time-consuming, so difficult, requires such a level of accuracy. I mean, the basic guideline is it should be 10 times more accurate and precise than the routine analytical data needs to be in terms of the reference value. Well, how in the world do you get there? Especially if, as people introduce a new method, which lets you measure something that could never be measured before, you're supposed to already have the reference material prove how well you're doing it. I mean, the whole argument is so circular.
So how do you break the cycle?
You acknowledge that, you know, the cart can't come before the horse, and that if I want an analytical result that is 10 times better than the routine data will ever be, it can't be ready the day the first routine data is developed.
I mean, were they trying to pressure that sort of time frame onto some of these questions at NIST?
I don't think NIST was trying. I think if you take some of the ISO standards totally seriously, and you take some of the laboratory accreditation requirements totally seriously, that's where you end up.
You mean with that sort of
mindset? With that sort of a totally impossible situation to try and deal with.
So I guess that your conclusion is that the only way to avoid that sort of circumstance would be to reconsider the certification guidelines that are being put into place.
Reconsider the certification guidelines, reconsider the definition of how an accredited laboratory will have proved, do far more. NIST does some publication of, you know, these are the methods we used in certification, but there are very, very few. I alluded to the fact that it, at CanMet, where they're working primarily with ores and, you know, with pricing an ore material or pricing a concentrate or, you know, buying and selling commercially important things, they've got a different set of accreditation guidelines and whatever. And I think so much of what happens needs to recognize that there are different circumstances. One size doesn't fit all in terms of what the regulations and the guidelines and the processes are. And then also realize that if the guideline is truly the impossible goal to be reached, as I think most of them are, that falling short isn't really a problem, that it still gives you something to strive for, and you can still stepwise do better and better. If you look for perfect compliance, the people writing the guidelines would have to do two things that they've never, to my satisfaction, done. They would have to provide worked examples of how they've gotten there on some of their own materials.
Right.
They would also have to do vastly more publication of their refined methods and their evaluation of where analytical error comes from. I mean, they're fundamentally asking anymore that every analytical result be able to show a traceability chain for accuracy back to a real metrological standard at every step of the analysis. Well, when I decompose this, I might be able, on my solution of a rock measured by AA, be able to do that for my mass in terms of the decomposition. I might be able to do it for my calibration standard of the instrument back to a NIST solution, single element solution, SRM, all the documentation they do in them. But I'm going to be hard-pressed to do it for, did I get 100% of that sample into solution, or did I leave 0.2% behind that I can't even see? And so you break a traceability chain every time you change the sample form, which has to be done in most chemical analyses. That traceability chain is much easier to document and think about in terms of a physical measurement.
So this is more of the stuff that was happening after NIST, correct?
This is, you know, the whole thought process through NIST and on into the IAG, and how does anybody, even a NIST or an IRMM, actually, on a practical level, achieve these standards that they write and describe? And I think, you know, I still think they're a touch esoteric, theoretical, and that the average guy who is supposed to be learning something about them and applying some of what they're talking about to every analysis he does and reports and to demonstrate the quality of it, really is in a totally impossible situation. And I wish they would get it a little more back down to earth. And that's what the IAG protocol tried to do for rock analysis. We now consider the IAG to be a liaison member of the International Organization for Standards, ISO. The French turns the letters around in terms of, and to have developed a protocol that is the closest that a non-in-house reference material certification can come, because again, they talk about demonstrating the quality of every laboratory that is contributing to a round robin database. And ASTM, when they're working with NIST, would have done this by virtue of the fact that they develop standard methods, and in documenting the standard method, they get 20 or 30 labs to use it and to report data, and so now the spread in the data becomes the interlab precision, the method. Of the reproducibility. Repeatability is within a lab in a single day or in a short period of time. Reproducibility is between laboratories using the same method or between laboratories using different methods for the same analysis. But everybody's supposed to do these things, and when the ASTM labs are contributing to a NIST standard because they've been part of the documentation of the accuracy of a standard method, you've had a way of qualifying them, of saying they are good enough. But when USGS, for instance, just sent their samples all over the world to anyone who said, I'm willing to do it, and the data spread might be a factor of two on trace elements, you haven't had any kind of control over the accuracy, and you don't know how many outliers compared to legitimate values you've got in that big wide data set.
Right, so you need to control not only the ultimate standard, but the way that the data
is collected
at every step along the way.
And so the IAG, when it was first formed, set up a proficiency testing program for rock labs and used the results of that proficiency testing program to identify which labs were likely to produce outlier data and which labs were right smack in the center of the database. And so then we used that for the qualification procedure, because geochemistry, there are no standard methods. Again, too many of the people who would be interested in analyzing the sample are university researchers. And if you want to publish something, it better be unique. And so you don't want to be doing anything that involves following a standard method. You want to be developing a new method. You want to be doing something unique and different. And those labs are the major contributors to the database. So the forcing them to participate in the proficiency test is a way of qualifying them to then contribute to the certification of a similar or even the same material. In some cases, it's the same material that's done in two rounds once to pick out the qualified labs and then send the same sample back to them. Other cases, you'll have two very similar materials, and one will become the standard after you've qualified them using the other.
So we've sort of segued during the course of this discussion from talking about NIST, I think, into your post-NIST.
Into my post-NIST work. So, and it's difficult not to, because they're so closely related.
So before we go full post-NIST.
Okay.
I guess I should ask a little bit about, at NIST, whether or not you had the opportunity to publish or present your work at conferences.
A great deal. It was fundamentally expected. Tom Gills preferred to be the one to tell me I was going to present X at conference Y. Enough people in the geological community would invite me to other kinds of conferences, and I would always get permission, but it would always be with a little bit of, even if you write the paper on your own time at home or during your 2 weeks of annual leave, I would like you to be working for me anytime you're working. And this is not directly for me. And, you know,
so this is about those control issues.
There's some of these control issues that were really, you know, terribly unfortunate, because one of the requirements in all of government service for the high-level grade that I had achieved at that time was that you be known as an expert around the, or at least beyond your own agency.
Right.
So if everything had to come through him and not name specific to me coming through him, then how do I meet that fundamental qualification for grade level? But he never saw it that way.
So did the tension between you two ultimately contribute to your decision to leave?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I left the very day that I was eligible to retire. And again, it was the control issues, and it was the fact that you couldn't talk about them. Because if we had been able to talk about them...
To talk about the control issues.
Yeah, we might have been able to resolve them.
Why weren't you able to talk about them?
A brick wall.
You mean you're talking about between you and
between the two of us. Between the two of us. I mean, it even got to the point somewhere along the way that a couple of folks in the analytical laboratories division, which did all the analytical work for us, said, wouldn't you be happier coming over here and getting out of SRMP?
And you said?
And I said, you know, I would feel awkward doing that. I was specifically sought out for SRMP in the first place. In the second place, you know, I didn't say to the person who raised the issue, but I knew in my own mind that this NIST superiority, that, you know, having most of the truly successful people at NIST had never worked anywhere else. And I had only 3 years at NIST in sales. So that I had the same sense that I had at USGS when I was asked to give up the instrument and go somewhere else, you know, go to another project, that indeed, even if I wasn't happy where I was, and by then I knew there were problems, that it was going to be worse doing something else. And what was, you know, again, with all these control issues, what was incredibly interesting to me, Arthi Prabhakar became the director of NIST sometime during my tenure there, and she didn't stay very long. But this was, other than Lori Filipek at USGS when she became BGC branch chief, and Gwendy Hall in Canada, who was the head of the analytical laboratories at Canadian Geological Survey, North America, these were the only women in really high positions that I had ever known and met.
I was going to ask a little about that.
And while Arthi was there, I do not remember at this point whether she was the speaker or whether it was someone she invited in. But the discussion was on mentoring, and the discussion was on the fact that some supervisors are poison mentors as opposed to helpful mentors. and thought it was very interesting that the very, very senior management at NIST could be talking about this. But all the way down the line, the poison mentoring was very, very real.
I mean, did you ever have the opportunity to mentor anyone during the course of either your USGS career or
USGS, NIST? When I took over the Flanagan Project, and they formally appointed a woman in Denver as the quality manager for the project. And we had met a couple of times, but she specifically asked me if I would function as her mentor. Which, you know, as I left a year or so later, was very difficult to do anything with, but we stayed in touch. And she ended up in 97, which is after I'd left, but she ended up in 1997 as program chairman for the geoanalysis meeting that year. I'm sorry, as general chairman for the geoanalysis meeting, and I was program chairman in retirement, but at the very first meeting in 1990, they asked me, as Flanagan's replacement, if I would consider serving as chairman for the next conference, and they were thinking in three-year terms, and USGS hosting it, obviously, in that case, that situation, and I just did not feel, having been told I couldn't have travel money for that meeting and I, you know, this, that, and the other, that I was in a position to say, yes, I'll guarantee you that NIST will do it. It was, I'll go back and talk to people about it. And we ended up not doing it until 1997. There was an intermediate conference in England while I was at NIST, where I mentioned that we had another field opportunity for reference material sample collection and that I helped teach the two-day training on certification process. But Belinda and I worked very, very closely in putting that 1997 conference together. And
Belinda was the woman in Denver. Okay. So I guess this gets to kind of your decision to leave NIST in a roundabout way. And this, as you said, kind of came down to the tensions you were having, both with the institutional culture at NIST being, very superior.
Very superior to anybody. I mean, they just had a hard time believing that anybody else could do quality work. They could eventually be convinced. But, we did use USGS for some of the certification work on the materials I worked on. We did use a few outside laboratories on the automotive catalyst platinum group certifications. We did a collaborative project with the Geological Survey of Poland. They came to NIST for training, as the Egyptians had come to USGS while I was there. And they worked on our soil standards, and I think they were actually developing some soil standards of their own that we helped them set up. And we definitely put leach data on the certificate. Again, the fundamental premise is that if you have two totally different methods of analysis that give you the same result, you've got accuracy demonstrated.
Right.
Well, obviously, if you have a single element technique like an EPA leach method, you can't have two independent methods of analysis.
Right.
So there, again, you're back to a collaboration between many laboratories. We did that on the sludge with the New Jersey EPA. We did that on the soils with the Polish group, where USGS and a couple of EPA labs and the Poles, I don't know who else, but all of those, you know, kinds of things were involved. And I suppose there's some degree of mentoring in that training and interlaboratory collaboration. But
beyond those few examples, generally you would characterize NIST as kind of NIST-focused.
NIST-focused. At least the part, you know, as I say, there were definitely pieces that were much more ASTM focused,
right,
and able to bring other people in, but not the work I specifically did.
So between that and kind of the tensions with your supervisor, you ultimately decide when you have the opportunity in 1995 to retire. What happens after that? I see here that you've marked down on the professional history you provided that you remained involved with geostandards and geoanalytical research.
Right. I stayed on the editorial board. I still write for them. And as I said, the International Association of Geoanalysts was kind of an outgrowth of the geoanalysis meetings. The Brits hosted the 1994 conference, and they had a fair amount of money left that they had to, having set it up as an educational organization rather than a commercial and all of that, they had to find some way to funnel that money into something that would remain educational. And so they formed the International Association of Geoanalysts and host a conference every 3 years. And that's, we're working on the 7th or the 8th. We're working on the 8th. The 7th was 2 years ago in South Africa. And that's the one where I had basically gotten to the point, I said, look, folks, I love this work, but sooner or later, we have to find somebody younger and somebody who is still connected with laboratory science, because I no longer am remotely current with laboratory techniques, with where geochemistry is going, and trying to stay current at home by myself just doesn't work. So I had been involved with them right from the beginning, as I say. I mean, immediately after I retired, I was working on putting the program together for the 97 conference. And after the 97 conference, they formed the proficiency testing program, and I was on the steering committee of that for 6 or 8 years. And then simultaneously, they were trying to form a certification committee and actually have the IAG become recognized by ISO as a certifying body. And I chaired the certification committee from its inception until 2006, 2007. I've lost track of when I handed it over. But in the meantime,
did ISO accept it?
Yes.
When was
we became a liaison member 2005, 2004.
Okay.
And have been a member ever since. Now, we're not big enough to be a full-fledged member rather than a connected, affiliated organization.
Right.
But we are still very much involved. And after we did a couple of our reference materials at the Beijing conference, geoanalysis conference in 2006, I had prepared the paper. I had initially planned to go, but after having a heart attack in February of 2006, I said, you know, If I have another one, and it hasn't been long enough since the last one to know whether this is an ongoing problem or not, there is no way in the world I want to be in Beijing with problems. So I prepared the talk, but I asked Phil Potts, with whom, right from the 1990 meeting, I have had the closest personal relationship and professional both. If there were in this whole geostandards area a mentor, Phil would be it, hands down, no questions asked. He was on the editorial board. He had worked with Govinda Raju on some of the earliest materials that the International Working Group, which was an offshoot of CRPG, had prepared. And he and I, literally right from day one, leaving the Geoanalysis 90 meeting, started voluminous correspondence on how we could do better with standards and how we could move things along. And so when he became editor-in-chief, again, my role in, I was going to be the lead reviewer on everything that had anything to do with standards, and I was going to help get the proficiency testing program off the ground, and I was going to work with him on setting up a certification committee within IAG, and then I literally did all of the data reduction personally on our first three materials, designed the protocol, told people what the experimental plan was going to be, was first author on the published IAG protocol for how you do a certification project.
Right.
Step by step along the way. We co-authored it with several other people because I didn't want it to be me. I thought the IAG with co-authors would have more credibility. But in terms of truly doing the work, I drafted it, Phil critiqued it. It was that partnership that got it off the ground and got the projects going and set it all in motion. We had now finished three. Two of the three were done in conjunction with the Mongolian Central Geological Laboratory. They had done the materials themselves 2000 or thereabouts. And they wanted to learn our protocol and our process and potentially improve the quality of the certified values in their project and add elements that they hadn't been able to do before. And they also had some of the most challenging matrices I ever want to work on, in terms of all kinds of analytical difficulties, either some elements being totally out of the range of the normal geological sample or being in a different mineral form than they appear in most rocks. And
right.
So we had some analytical challenges with those that we hadn't had with the others. It was not as successful as either they or I would have liked, except as a training exercise for other people. And that training exercise involved Thomas Meisel at the University of Leuven or something like that in Austria, who became certification committee chairman probably right before we did that training meeting. But we also involved some people from Germany who had been consulting with the Mongolian laboratories on all of their standards work. And so the training really addressed all of these people who were hopefully going to take over and follow along behind me and fill in the gaps. Unfortunately, job pressures for people who are working full-time, when this is related to but not really the work of their own institution, is incredibly difficult to find. We had thought we would have two new standards finished shortly after a Goldschmidt conference in 2009, where I went to Kentucky and spent a week, or Tennessee. We were at the University of Tennessee, and I spent a week with them going through all of the data they'd collected, all of the data reduction they'd started on. And there were still issues, and they wanted to tweak it and finalize it and make it a little better. Well, I haven't seen a draft certificate yet. So I don't know whether that's simply because they felt I'd step back to the point that it would be an imposition.
Right.
Or whether they really haven't yet been able to finish the project.
And you're still right now in the role of overseeing kind of the certification program, or you step back?
I've stepped back. I mean, Thomas, as chairman, having taken over from me 2006, 2007, somewhere in that time frame, is supposed to be the lead person on
Thomas,
all of this. Thomas Meisel.
Oh,
at Logan or whatever it is.
The Austrian
University. The Austrian University. I mean, the intent was really, hey, folks, you know, 15 years out of the lab and away from geological literature and all of that kind of thing, I just can't.
No, this is just preparing an institutional transition.
Transition.
Right?
And the transition, again, because the International Association of Geoanalysts is all, it's a professional society like ACS or whatever, but it's a very small group with relatively few members who are scattered all over the world.
Sure.
I mean, we've got people in Mongolia, we've got people in China, we've got people in Brazil, we've got Canada, the U.S., Denver, Washington, whatever.
Right.
It's impossible to maintain a really tight working relationship and collegiality. Email's wonderful, and it makes things a whole lot simpler than it used to be, but it really doesn't fill the gap.
So that actually is a wonderful kind of transition towards the last set of questions I have written down here,
okay,
which is about how the field has changed over the course of your career.
All right. Could we take 2 minutes and let me head out that way, and then I will come back and answer those questions?
All right. Let me pause the recorder for a moment. All right, and the recorder's going again. So when we paused for that brief moment, I mentioned that the last set of questions that I have are about kind of changes in geochemistry and geoanalysis. Since you entered the field in the 1970s, and also more broadly kind of what it's like for women in science since your time, since your original entry, rather, in the 50s and 60s. So I guess there are a couple of different ways we can approach this. One would be to talk about something you've touched on already, which are kind of major questions or major changes in techniques that have
been... Well, there have been tremendous changes in the analytical techniques available, which means that totally different geological processes can be studied and explored and looked at than could have been before. I think the biggest difference is that we have gone from bulk analyses to microanalyses in terms of being able to sample laser ablation ICP mass spec to take a solid crystal and look at changes in the chemistry spot by spot across a crystal. So that before, you knew bulk chemistry, but you didn't know the variation within a rock in quite the same way. the heterogeneity of a material, looking at zoning in a crystal,
right,
where you've got some elements forming, you know, almost like a coconut shell rim, and then moving inward and the changing composition. So they can do an enormous amount of that that they couldn't do before. The other biggest change is that with ICP mass spec, again, they are able to do all kinds of isotopic studies that could not have been done before.
You didn't talk too much about the mass spec side of this story.
No, I didn't use mass spec, but myself. The ICP, shortly after the ICP optical emission came in,
right,
you ended up with ICP mass spectrometry, where you were coupling the plasma with the mass spectrometer instead of with an optical emission spectrometer. And that opens up, again, all kinds of opportunities for, one, it gives you an independent method, which you didn't have before, but it also gives you the opportunity to look at the isotopic variations within this. And the isotopes are not the things I've got anything but a passing acquaintance with, but there is an isotopic fractionation that occurs in the Earth with some specific elements. And then there is also the fact that some of them are radioactive elements, and so they will decay. And so the decay time,
right,
being able to monitor the decay, lets you put an age date on the rock.
Certainly.
So in terms of, if you are really trying to see, is this a recent event or is this an ancient event?
Right.
And how did the rock change over time? As, for instance, a cooling magma will fractionate because each of the individual crystal forms that might come out of that initial melt,
right,
has a different solidification temperature.
Okay.
And so you can see whether it cooled rapidly, you can see whether it cooled very, very slowly and gradually, and you can...
So that has less of an issue to do, for example, with a standard material, because you'd want
Well, except that you want an isotopic standard now that you never needed before.
So you now need to incorporate these time changes into the story.
You now need to be able to have an isotopic standard. And IAEA is the one who has done most of the stable isotopes in all kinds of materials rather than the geological surveys, but NIST has been involved as well. And I mean, the whole isotopic story is a huge one. It's the one I am least familiar with. It's also the one that is newest in terms of the ready accessibility. I mean, we've had mass spectrometry for a very long time, but thermal ionization mass spec, for instance, which is always used for the isotope dilution type analytical work, is exceedingly tedious. It is very much single element. I mean, you have to get your one isotope,
right,
totally separated from everything else. And so with ICP mass spec, all of those issues go away. So again, it's been a progression from single element, major oxide concentrations, or major down to a tenth of a percent concentrations only, to being able to measure at the part per billion level and to be able to look at spatial variation within a single crystal or a rock. And being able to look at isotopic changes as well as chemical composition.
And also looking at multiple elements, as
and
you
looking
were
saying. At, yeah, again, the gross efficiency of going from single element to multi-element.
Right, and then bulk to
and bulk
micro.
To micro.
And include this new time.
And including the isotopic composition as well as just the strict chemical.
So those are the big trends.
And those are the big trends.
Okay.
And those have all developed really in the time that I was working through this.
Now, did you notice a change in the way that the geosciences in general engaged with public debates about science or in the public sphere during the time that you were involved?
Modestly, but not hugely. There is a major research group over in the UK, for example, that is looking at sampling in the environment and how much of the variation, you know, as you're monitoring a toxic element and you're looking for a hot spot, is it really all concentrated? Are there halos? Are there, you know, and then also wanting to say that for this area, unless you take thousands of samples, you can't possibly get a truly representative sample, and a single sample will never give you an indication of how polluted the things are. Trying not only what the measurement error is, but what the error in terms of selecting samples, because, think of water puddling on an uneven surface. The puddles are not uniform depths. They're not uniform sizes. They're not, and that kind of thing can happen with a toxic element as it's moving through the soil. If there's different water, you know, if you've got a water course through one place that isn't in another, so that exactly how you map out your sampling locations.
Right.
And I'm not totally taken with what they're doing, but again, this is kind of in the public policy sphere of what does it take to get an analysis and an analytical program, including choosing the sample, that is sufficient to define the problem for a public policy solution to be applicable.
Okay. So not much of an increase as far as you've observed.
From the analytical side of things. I've been away from it 15 years.
So okay.
What has happened since I left? But a growing awareness of the fact that we had to be paying attention to these problems and, frankly, educating people because one of the talks we did at Geoanalysis 97 was about the lead pollution in Colorado and the fact that most of the lead that is a source of difficulty in Colorado is a naturally occurring ore vein of lead. And that, you know, we've got to distinguish between the lead that is there in the ground and that we really can't do anything about.
Right.
And the lead that is an environmental problem as opposed to a natural environmental occurrence. And you have to also understand that just because it's there and a toxic metal in the right form doesn't mean it's in the form to be a problem. And what that brings to mind is the chromium-6, chromium-3 story. Chromium-6 is highly toxic. Everyone worries about chromium-6 pollution. But in the soil, the redox potential of natural soil is such that chromium 6 will disappear overnight. It will become chromium 3. And I don't need to remove it if it's in its non-toxic form. So there's been, over time, there's been a growing awareness of and interest in standards developed in relation to these kinds of issues. But I don't think it bleeds into public policy in a way that affects it sensibly.
Okay.
As you know, as I mentioned with the lead in water, if the drinking water standard is 5.0 parts per billion, and I've got some places measuring 5.1 and other places measuring 500, but I treat them as equally dangerous, they're not. There's really some understanding of what's going on that gets lost in the public policy end of things, and I wish there were a better way. I wish we as scientists were better at communicating this stuff. I wish the public were better able to receive the communication. And the general illiteracy on most of this stuff is amazing.
All right. Another question then, sort of related to that. It's about encouraging greater scientific literacy and kind of broader, more broadly, scientific education, especially among women and other underrepresented groups. Have you noticed a change over the course of your career in efforts to reach out to these different groups to get them more involved in geochemistry or geoanalysis?
I've probably been too far away from where that kind of interaction would take place with young people. But my concern, as I look at things like the standards of learning and No Child Left Behind, is this sense that we can demand that everyone be at the same place at the same time, and that the schools are failing if they're not. And it's so much more complicated than that. I don't want anyone to fail, but I don't want to define success such that 1,000 children, all at the end of their academic careers, be at exactly the same place in every single subject. And I'm afraid we've done a lot of that. And we've also put pressure on teachers at the early levels to focus so exclusively on math and reading that the playing with magnets, the playing with magnification glasses and learning nature and all of that kind of thing, which should be, if we want a scientifically literate public, very much a part of young children's lives, gets crowded out of the schools.
Do you have any advice for women who are thinking about studying chemistry or are entering the sciences more broadly?
Go for it. It's fascinating. The doors are far more widely open than they once were. Society is much more comfortable with the idea of women working outside of the home, even when they have young children. The childcare opportunities are much broader. But also, just plain be flexible. Not everyone is going to want the kind of very, very intense career that a person like Mary Good had. And there's no reason everyone should be striving for that. So the kind of, I think the opportunity for the kind of flexibility that I've experienced in my career, or my lifetime, because it goes well beyond career that I'm still experiencing it, is that the world is much more open to people being themselves and to not fitting into a mold. And so much of what made things work for me were the totally accidental, utterly serendipitous things that happened along the way of life that, you know, you can start out with a plan and you have an idea where you want to go, but let the plan bend and flex as opportunities come up. Just grab opportunities. Don't be afraid to take a chance.
All right. Those are the questions that I had prepared, pretty much all of them. Wow. But at this point, before we wrap up, I normally like to pause and ask if there's anything else that you'd like to add, if there's any question that if you were in my position, you would have asked yourself, or if there's just anything else you'd like to add to the
record. I think
the
one comment I would add that I kind of glossed over is we were talking about meetings and this, that, and the other, mentors and then basically the feedback that says this is great. I've been fairly critical of how esoteric so many of the ISO standards are. And I've alluded to the fact that we tried with the IAG protocol to make things much more practical and truly doable.
Right.
For the ordinary person as opposed to or organization, but not the really high-powered NIST and IRMM. The paper that Phil and I presented at GeoAnalysis 2006 in Canada, once it was published, generated the feedback from the chairman of ISO-REMCO that they really needed to pay more attention to the practical stuff that I was talking about, and that they were glad somebody had put some of it on paper. And I think that was, you know, one of the most gratifying things, period, in all that I had done through this. And the other, of course, the GeoAnalysis 2009 that I had mentioned was in South Africa. Phil Potts organized a session that was a tribute to what I had contributed to the IAG. And that was also, again, enormously gratifying. I gave the opening invited lecture that was the summary of everything we had accomplished to date, but then other people who had worked with me in one way or another over the years in the IAG spoke about some part of the reference material work we'd done jointly. And that was a fantastic capstone.
Well, I think on that happy note, that unless you have anything else to add,
no, that's
I think we're going to wrap up. So thank you so much for taking the time to share all of these fascinating stories about your career in chemistry and in geochemistry and in retirement, too.
Indeed.
All right. I guess I will stop the recorder now. We've been talking for about 2 hours and 43 minutes. And when I hit this button, it'll be exactly half a minute after that. So.